Tens of thousands of Somali Americans have escaped a brutal civil war in their homeland and now call Minnesota home. But their journey in the United States has been fraught with new dangers. This month's triple homicide at a Minneapolis corner store was just the latest tragedy to hit this community. Authorities have charged two teenage Somali boys in that fatal shooting of three East African immigrants. At least 11 young men of Somali descent have been killed in the Twin Cities since December of 2007. Minneapolis police say Somali gangs are on the rise, and the FBI says about 20 men left for Somalia to join a gang of another kind, Al-Shabaab. The U.S. government describes it as a terrorist group with ties to Al-Qaeda. Community leaders say these stories point to something much larger. They believe many Somali American young people, especially young men, have lost their way. Laura Ewan has spent the past year reporting these stories, and now she takes us inside Minnesota's Somali community, the largest in the country. She explores the trap of violence that some young men have fallen into in the first of a three-part series, Civil War Kids, Young Somalis in Minnesota.
The first stop for many new Somali refugees is here, in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood of Minneapolis. You can buy phone cards, you can send money to Mogadishu, you can even buy a hookah, all on the same block. I see middle-aged women walking from store to store with their cell phones tucked under their headscarves. Across the street from me are a number of high-rise buildings in faded colors. They're home to thousands of Somali newcomers who have restarted their lives here with nothing. But among those newcomers are some disaffected young men who are causing the most harm to their own people. What many see as a crisis has a big cost. On a recent afternoon, a group of mourners is shoveling heaps of dirt onto three caskets. Men at this gravesite chant in Arabic, "There is no God but Allah." This is exactly how Somalis bury their dead in Mogadishu, one of the most violent places in the world. But this cemetery is in a suburb of Minneapolis, and the dead men in the caskets all thought they escaped the bloodshed when they settled in the United States. Two of the men were from Somalia, and the third was from Ethiopia. All three men were around 30 and were shot to death at the Seward Market and Halal Meat Shop in Minneapolis. Rama Warfa lost both her brother and cousin in one night.
I don't know what's going on with the community. It's sad that we left the civil war to look for a peaceful country, and then we come to a peaceful country and still kill ourselves.
Prosecutors say two Somali boys, both 17, killed the three men during a botched robbery. It's not clear if either teen was involved with gangs, but the shootings are part of a grim cycle of violence within the Somali-American community. Murshid Barud is a first cousin of two of the victims. Barud says he wasn't surprised that the suspects were so young. He says a lot of Somali-American boys are growing up poor and fatherless in the inner city, and they're turning to the streets for their role models.
All of that combined, I think they are becoming a lot more dangerous than anyone ever expected them to be.
These troubled young men are in their teens or 20s. They were essentially born into a civil war. They've heard the stories from their parents of Somalia's beautiful beaches, but in their lifetime, they've only known their homeland as a failed state. Karma Plaza in Minneapolis is one of the Somali malls where many young men flock. A lanky young man settles into a booth in one of the restaurants. 31-year-old Abdulkader Sharif looks like he's been swallowed by his puffy hooded jacket. He orders spaghetti and a pitcher of pink fruit juice, a surprising pick from someone who says he was once a gang boss. Sharif scrolls through his call log on his smartphone.
How is it that you have a BlackBerry? I thought you didn't know how to read.
I'm a businessman.
Besides being a businessman, Sharif is also a Civil War kid. He came to the U.S. in the mid-90s when he was 17, illiterate in both English and Somali. His parents were still in Africa, so Sharif's only guardian at the time was an older sister. She couldn't get him in line. He drank, smoked pot, and dropped out of school. Sharif jokes that if he were still in Somalia, he would have grown up to become a warlord. But as a young refugee navigating Minneapolis, he says he sold drugs and helped create one of the first Somali gangs in the Twin Cities. A telltale scar on Sharif's neck reminds him why he quit running the streets. In 2007, a man from a rival gang stabbed him in the throat. The knife wound permanently damaged Sharif's vocal cords. While Sharif was laid up in the hospital, an imam who prayed with him took Sharif under his wing. That's when Sharif vowed to join the mosque and get to work.
I'm trying to change another life.
Sharif takes pride in his job at the mosque, where he works as part youth counselor part bouncer. He even bought a metal security badge that he keeps in his wallet.
See, that's what I get.
While Sharif has become a symbol of personal redemption in the community, he knows his future is limited. Sharif is a convicted felon who has served time in prison for stealing a car, so he's eligible for deportation. But the U.S. government rarely sends criminals back to Somalia because the country has no functioning government. So young offenders like Sharif, who come here legally, lose their immigration status and are in limbo. It makes it difficult to find work.
I'm trying to get my papers straight. I don't have no ID. I need to get an ID. I need to get a green card. I need to get a work permit.
Sharif says he's steered young men off the streets and that he's paid for his crimes many times over. Sharif says a lot of his old friends with lengthy rap sheets are living dead-end lives. At outreach meetings with Somali residents, it's Officer Janine Brudenell's job to listen. Brudenell has the peaceful posture of a yoga instructor, which is her side job. Her full-time job is the Somali community liaison. It's a unique position that Minneapolis police created in response to the escalating violence. Brudenell is also the department's resident expert on Somali gangs. Brudenell says there are just 7 documented Somali gangs in the area, with names like Somali Mafia and the Somali Outlaws. They make up just a small fraction of known gangs in Minnesota, and their actions have mostly been contained.
Overall, if you look at the majority of crime that occurs, it's Somali on Somali.
She says Somali gang members have been successful in intimidating older Somalis because they know they have the upper hand. She says immigrant merchants may be less likely to report robberies or coercion to police.
They may not speak English. They may not fully understand the criminal justice system or have a fear of government and law enforcement they've brought with them.
Minneapolis Somali gangs started in the late 90s. The Hot Boys, one of the first, began as a singing group. Brudenell says they built a reputation in the community and then committed crimes to back it up. She says it's almost as if they bought into their own hype. Over time, the gangs grew more emboldened, and now the second generation of Somali gangs has become more violent than ever. Brudenell says Somali gangs are more fluid than traditional gangs. They have no hierarchy or formal recruitment. Many members don't even consider themselves a gang. They think of themselves as cliques or organizations. To Brudenell, there is no doubt that these groups are gangs.
There are plenty of cliques, the Girl Scouts, the Boy Scouts. But when you have a group of people together and they choose to commit crimes, that is when they become a gang.
It's the semifinals for a young men's basketball tournament at the Midtown YWCA in Minneapolis. A crowd of spectators fills the metal bleachers. Teams that go by the names Somali Tigers or simply Minneapolis are vying to advance to the finals. The stakes are high, even for this community league. When a ref calls a foul, some of the players lose their tempers.
Looks like we're gonna have a fight, guys. A big one.
Youth worker Abdullahi Farah, in his black leather jacket, is watching from the sidelines. Farah is a volunteer who's trying to keep some of these young men out of trouble. He says while things can get heated, this is a better place for them to work out their frustrations.
Instead of talking about, you know, I'm going to shoot this guy or I'm going to beat up this guy, they have like saying, you know what, hey, let's take it to the court.
Over the summer, Farah's group, the Somali Youth Network Council, hired young men from the neighborhood to talk one-on-one with at-risk youth. At the time, there was a turf war between some of the city's Somali neighborhoods. Farah says the feuds often began with what he calls a beef, but they could escalate over Facebook and text messages into a war with guns and deadly consequences. The rash of murders started about 2 years ago. 7 Somali American men were killed in less than a year, and the gang violence began to claim lives of people with no gang ties at all. An Augsburg College student who was working as a youth mentor was shot to death. Police believe the gunman was a 16-year-old boy who was upset because the mentor told him he couldn't play basketball. Many of the homicides were acts of retribution for previous shootings, and most remain unsolved. Abdullahi Farah has seen kids go down the wrong path. He says boys who begin to pull away from sports or other activities should be a warning sign to parents.
Age 12, they're usually active. Age 13, 14. This is when they finding friends and stuff like that. Around age 15, 16, they should be finding their hobby or something that, you know, their friends are getting into. But when they hit like 18, either they continue that hobby and they take that positive direction, or they just kind of lose that happy real quick. You know, that's when the alarm should be going off.
One law enforcement official with experience fighting urban gangs is now tackling a gang of a different breed.
My name is Ralph Bolter. I'm the special agent in charge of the Minneapolis division of the FBI.
Over a long career with the FBI, Bolter went after violent gangs and organized crime in big cities. A picture in his office shows him as a young street agent escorting a man in handcuffs. That man belonged to a ruthless gang of armored car robbers in Boston. Now, Bolter has a new opponent. Al-Shabaab is a militant Islamic group fighting to overthrow the Somali government. The group's recruitment of young Somali Americans from Minnesota was something Bolter never saw before. Court documents say it all started in 2007, when young men from the Twin Cities began holding secret meetings to discuss the Ethiopian military occupation of their homeland. The U.S.-backed invasion of Somalia drew outrage from Somalis around the world. Eventually, up to 20 Twin Cities men, brimming with testosterone and religious fervor, allegedly enlisted with Al-Shabaab. It means the youth in Arabic. The group has carried out suicide bombings and mortar attacks in the name of Islam. Bolter says his agency needs to win the trust of young Somali Americans to fight domestic radicalization. His agency has taken the unusual step of meeting face-to-face with young people. They've told Bolter about what it's like to live in poverty or to face discrimination from police or to feel alienated from their own parents.
And these are factors that create fertile ground for dissatisfaction, frustration, and I think those feelings, those emotions feed one's vulnerability to being influenced to do something that perhaps you and I would not do.
No one is suggesting that Minneapolis gangs are a pipeline to Al-Shabaab. The reasons why a young man would enlist in either a gang or a terrorist group are complex. But in many cases, the root of their decisions is similar. The most disaffected young men are trying to connect with something. One of those young men trying to connect was Zakaria Marouf. Marouf was lured by both Somali gangs in Minneapolis and by Al-Shabaab in Somalia, and he met a tragic fate in his homeland. By all accounts, Marouf was a magnetic figure in every social circle he passed through.
He was the well-known one. He was the one that girls liked. He was the famous one. He was the loud one, the one that people listened to.
That's 24-year-old Zuhair Ahmed. She's the only woman in the Twin Cities to host a Somali news show. Somali Community Link airs every Monday night on the radio station KFAI. A couple of years ago, Ahmed invited Zakaria Marouf to be a guest on her show about why young Somali men were killing each other in Minneapolis. Marouf was a former gang member who turned religious several years ago. Friends say he struggled because of his criminal history. Marouf eventually found work as a Walmart stock boy. On a recent evening, Ahmed went back to listen to a recording of the old show. Marouf's comments reveal a young man's disillusionment with life in his adopted country. In the interview, Marouf told her why he decided to leave the Hot Boys.
One day I was at Cedar here in Minnesota, and it was me and a bunch of other youth. An older Somali man came to us. He came by and he stepped and he told us, "Are you always going to be living this life?" We laughed at the old man. But when I rethought about what he said, it left a mark.
Marouf appeared on the radio show in October 2007. Little did Ahmed know, that's about the same time Marouf was allegedly plotting with other young men to join Al-Shabaab. A few months later, he left for Somalia. Friends heard Marouf was killed last summer in the fighting. Five other Al-Shabaab recruits from Minnesota are also believed dead, including one who became a suicide bomber. Zuhair Ahmed says, it's eerie listening to Zakaria Marouf's voice.
God knows how I feel about it. It's just scary now to know that he died and, you know, joined these crazy groups that are blowing themselves up.
On the show, Ahmed asks Marouf why the youth are joining street gangs. Marouf places most of the blame on his parents' generation and community leaders. He refers to a coffee shop on Riverside Avenue where Somali cab drivers and elders get into heated discussions about the affairs of the homeland.
The community are busy with themselves. The fathers go to Starbucks.
Yeah, they're chatting.
They're chatting. They're talking about we are Clan A, Clan B. The reason why we here and flee Somali is because of Clan A and B. I am not a Clan A and B. Why can they not be busy with us and talk about us and help us?
Maruf said the parents have become helpless. They don't speak the language, and they don't know what's going on with their kids. When Zuhair Ahmed listens to Maruf, she says she hears a sense of disappointment that she didn't notice at the time of the interview. Ahmed believes there's a connective thread between the reasons why a young man might join a gang and why he might enlist with a terrorist group.
When you feel like you're neglected by your own parents, by your own people, by your own community leaders, by your own father, then you are vulnerable to anything. I don't even think they would need drugs or anything to really lead them to join Al-Shabaab or gang groups, because at least they have a group that's calling for them. At least they have sense of belongings. At least they have a place where they are the center of attention.
Ahmed says young people just want to be noticed, but they weren't noticed here.
Somali refugees who came to Minnesota were lucky to flee a bloody civil war that has been raging in their East African homeland for nearly two decades. But the trauma of seeing their loved ones killed or tortured can linger long after resettling in a new country. Many are struggling with mental illness. Laura Ewan has spent the past year reporting on issues affecting Minnesota's Somali community, the largest in the country. And in our second of a three-part series, Civil War Kids, Young Somalis in Minnesota, she explores the psychological scars felt by the young generation.
Five men, all born in Somalia, gather around a dinner table. In the South Minneapolis bungalow, they play chess, watch soccer, they swap jokes and cigarettes. They know one another like brothers. But it wasn't blood that brought them together. It was mental illness. Ismail Osman does most of the talking.
I'm very lucky to be here because it's one of the nicest places I've ever been for the last 10 years.
Osman and his housemates share this Somali cultural group home for men with mental illness. They've struggled with substance abuse, post-traumatic stress, bipolar disorder, and in Osman's case, even homelessness. Osman says he had big dreams when he escaped Somalia's civil war and arrived in America. He was 17.
When I came here, my goal was to be a movie star.
You can see how a guy like Osman might believe he would be famous one day. At 28, he's a big guy with a large personality to match. And his childhood memories from Somalia are the stuff of Hollywood movies, the violent kind. It's just that processing those memories is still painful.
I don't like to say it, but I kind of did some horrible things that I don't like to talk about it.
Osman says he witnessed the murder of his aunt and uncle. He watched a young girl get brutally raped. He's still haunted by what he saw and by what he did. He doesn't give details, but he says he was only 12, yet big enough to carry an assault rifle.
My nightmares usually is I get shot on my sleep. Somebody will come and say, "You remember me, Ismail? You kill me. You take my life. Now I'm here to take yours." And I jump out of bed. I'm sweating, hot, you know. Sometimes I get up screaming.
Osman says after he came to Minneapolis, he drank to wash away his memories. His housemate, Mukhtar Hussein Abdi, started drinking about 3 years ago when he was 21. But he says he just liked to party.
It was, just the love of it. I never had a rough time, you know. I never went through torture or anything, hunger or anything, no.
Abdi says he stole cars, got into fights, and drove drunk. He racked up felonies. And his struggle with bipolar disorder made it even more harrowing for his family.
Pain, my tears fall down. My family hopeless, you know, they see me, this guy.
Abdi is wearing a crisp black baseball cap and a plaid button-down shirt. He says he finds wisdom and inspiration from hip-hop, but he knows that the swagger he learned from Tupac and Snoop Dogg may not have been the best influence for a young man trying to find his way in a new land. Abdi is reflective when he thinks about the pain he caused his brothers and sisters. He now realizes his behavior was unacceptable.
I come home drunk. I go start a fight with my brother for no reason. My sisters get involved. They hold me. They hold my brother. You know, and then I smash a chair. And then I smash the microwave. And there's no subject to fight for. It's just that, the alcohol and what it do.
Everyone at the table can relate to an aching desire to belong. Asman says he felt overwhelmed coming from a Muslim country where alcohol wasn't tolerated to an American youth culture where parties and booze were abundant. He recalls his rush to fit in. Asman says his parents couldn't comprehend the choices he was making. They kicked him out of the house on a cold winter night when he says they should have put him in treatment instead. Asman eventually dropped out of the 11th grade. Now he's going back to school to get his GED. But to this day, he says his father won't accept him because of his past indiscretions.
You know, he look at me and say, you are a failure. Here you're 27, 8, whatever years old you are, and you don't have a degree.
Asman says his father doesn't seem to believe that his mental health struggles are real.
For Somalis, as I understand it, they have no concept of mental illness except as crazy.
Social worker David McGraw-Shuckman is warming up with some hot tea in his Minneapolis office.
And when they think of crazy, it's like extreme cases, like practically throwing off your clothes in public kind of crazy. So you're either crazy or you're sane.
Shuckman's clinic, run by the nonprofit Volunteers of America, focuses solely on East Africans. He says it's important to recognize that every refugee in the Somali American community has been affected in some way by the civil war. If they weren't shot at, their relatives were. But he says many aren't getting the help they need. In fact, there are no words in the Somali language to describe the continuum of mental illness. Some Somalis refer to depression as gulub. It's the same word that describes the sadness a female camel feels after she's lost her baby. Shuckman recalls going to an elders meeting to drum up support for his services in the 90s, but he says he went about it the wrong way.
Well, I realized that what the people had heard was, if you know any crazy people, call David. So they were very polite, of course, but nobody called because nobody wants to admit that they're crazy or anybody else is crazy.
Over the years, Shuckman has learned to avoid focusing on diagnoses. Instead, he'll talk about symptoms. He'll ask his clients if they have problems sleeping or if they feel anxious. Sometimes their mental anguish produces real physical pain. Social worker Abdullahi Mohammed is driving through South Minneapolis to visit a client. Many of the young Somali American people he works with are stuck somewhere between the first generation immigrants and second generation Americans. Born in Somalia, they came to the States at a young age and had problems adjusting. So they dropped out of school and either joined gangs or picked up drugs and alcohol.
I really feel like, you know, the youth are trying their best to fit in. They're trying to survive the way they know how to.
In the end, Mohammed says, they were rejected by both the American and Somali communities. Mohammed was born in Somalia, and while he feels empathy for some of the Somali American youth, he realizes those feelings aren't shared by everyone.
The community doesn't have understanding of what really these young ones are going through. They are just seen as bad kids, and they made these choices.
He says part of the problem is that when a family resettles in a new country, the roles of parents and children can reverse themselves. Mohammed says Somali parents learned once they arrived in America that they couldn't discipline their children by hitting them. One of their top parenting tools was now considered child abuse. Meanwhile, their kids picked up English with relative ease, and they became interpreters for their parents.
So parents become powerless. Children become powerful.
When Somali Americans talk about a crisis among their children, they're usually referring to their sons. After all, young men are the ones joining gangs and killing shopkeepers. The success stories often belong to Somali girls who are staying out of trouble and graduating from college. Professor Awa Abdi has done a lot of research on the gender question within her community. And she says it's hard to say if Somali women are truly doing better than men in this country. But Abdi, who teaches sociology at the University of Minnesota, says the patriarchal Somali culture has actually helped girls here in the long run.
There was more scrutiny also, of course, paid to girls, because when boys and girls spend a lot of time outside, it's the girl who can come back pregnant, not the boy. So what it meant is that girls are staying close to home, they're doing their homework, they're succeeding in high school, whereas some of the boys are not doing that.
In Somalia, she says, parents saw no harm in shooing their sons out of the house because they knew other adults would be watching out for them. But that approach didn't work once parents moved their children to Minneapolis. The boys were sent outside, where drug dealers and gangs roamed the street corners. Abdullahi Mohammed, the social worker, arrives at his client's doorstep in South Minneapolis. But this client is a parent, not a child. Sophia Mohammed is a single mom raising five kids in a sparse Minneapolis duplex. Sophia is in the kitchen frying chicken. A pot of mac and cheese for her young daughters is bubbling on the stove. Sophia's family embodies some of the biggest challenges for struggling Somali families in Minnesota. She feels like she has no control over her teenage boys. She's depressed, and she worries that she's not capable of nurturing her youngest kids. Sophia says she knows she's not well.
I'm sick. You come to America, I'm sick. I'm very, very sick.
She describes the pressure in her head, and in her words, she doesn't speak English nice. Sophia used to be a businesswoman in Somalia, running her own grocery. But when the war broke out, her life of comfort quickly slipped away. She lost her home, her business, her mother, and even her husband. He fled in a separate direction, and she only learned he was alive and in Kenya 2 years after she heard he was killed. She still talks to her husband on the phone every day, but she hasn't been able to bring him to the States because of immigration problems. Sophia knows his absence is taking a toll on their children.
Their dad is not here, and that's the problem. Since I've been in this country, I haven't worked. I'm sick. They need a lot of things that I can't give them. They feel neglected.
But it's her three oldest children who give her the most stress. They're all boys.
Right now I'm worried because they don't have jobs. They can't go to school because they're over school age. They don't do anything here. And there are bad kids outside standing in the streets, and I'm worried that they may influence them. If my sons join that group, there's going to be trouble.
Sophia's youngest daughter, 12-year-old Hodan, never met her father. She says if her dad were around, he could help the family.
He can make my brother stop doing bad stuff.
What kind of bad stuff?
I don't really know because I don't get inside their business.
Hodan says it's not easy seeing her mom when she's sick, like she was just a few days ago.
And she was on the bed. She's sleeping most of the time.
The family receives about $1,100 a month in public assistance. But Sophia, with no job or car, doesn't feel like she's becoming self-sufficient. Her reality is nothing like what she envisioned for her family when she moved them to America. She's told her daughters of the odyssey that brought them to Minnesota, of how they escaped the fighting in Somalia by illegally crossing into other African countries, of how she was attacked in a Botswana jail and lost her two front teeth. Sophia tells these stories to her children in Somali and broken English. They respond in English and broken Somali. And the result is a generation gap as old as the immigrant story.
When they came here, they adopted the American way of life so easily, but it's still difficult for me.
Sophia Mohammed says her children have been able to forget Somalia, but she says it's impossible for her to forget.
In this final report, we're going to focus on the other side of the immigrant experience, resilience and success. Hundreds of young Somali-American refugees graduate from Minnesota colleges every year. Others are going into careers in medicine and public policy. Truth is, most of the kids rarely make the news because they stay out of trouble. They embrace their Somali heritage, give back to their broader community. There are far more success stories than failures. Laura Ewan takes us back now to where she began this hour, namely in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood of Minneapolis.
Behind the gritty high-rises is the Brian Coyle Community Center. It's a squat brick building that has become the common space for the thousands of people who live in this development they call the Towers. Immigrant families speaking Spanish and Somali have come in from the cold to wait in the hallway of the Brian Coyle Center. Tonight, there's a lottery of sorts. But the people in line aren't here to get rich. They're here to receive donated winter clothing. And the children of the Towers are running the show.
What do you want? Hats, gloves, mittens, scarves?
The kids manning a table are making their pitches like hawkers at a street market.
You want a sweater?
How about a headband?
Oh yeah, that's a good size.
One boy shows an older Somali woman how to wrap a purple fleece headband around her forehead over her hijab. The kids raised money and organized the clothing drive themselves.
We gave back to the community by buying new jackets, hats, gloves.
That's Muhammad Jama, or as everyone here calls him, MJ. Ask people at the Coyle Center to tell you a story of hope from the Cedar Riverside neighborhood, and they often point to this skinny kid with glasses who's growing up before their eyes. At 16, MJ is the man of his house. He shares an apartment in the towers with his mom and two younger sisters. Just about every night of the week, you can find MJ at the Coyle Center, doing homework, playing basketball, joking with the security guards. MJ says mentors at the center helped him come out of his shell, and in a way that only kids can do, he can speak of the year 2007 as if it were ancient history.
I used to be shy, 2007, but I broke the glass. I learned how to speak properly with others, then it just happened. Voila.
That's when he joined the neighborhood's youth council and started to take on big responsibilities. Countless kids like MJ are succeeding despite grim statistics in their community. More than 82% of Somali Americans in Minnesota live in or near poverty, and Somali adults are much less likely to have a high school education compared with other adults. MJ and his friends live in an area that's home to the largest concentration of Somalis in the U.S., and the towers, which are six apartment buildings in faded colors, have become the dubious landmark for this largely low-income neighborhood. MJ's younger and much shorter pal, Salah Ali, is just 13, but it seems as if Salah has known his entire life what outsiders think of Cedar Riverside.
People say, oh, Cedar's like a bad place, Somalians, and they start comparing us to other terrorists like the 9/11. They just look at us like, why are those girls wearing a headscarf? Why are gangsters all over the place?
Salah says he wants people to think his neighborhood is a good place. Yet it was here, just outside the Coyle Center, where a Somali-American college student was shot to death in late 2008. The alleged gunman was a 16-year-old boy who was upset because he wasn't allowed to play basketball. Two other young men were also killed that year in Cedar Riverside. Abdurrahman Mukhtar runs the youth programs at the Coyle Center. He says young Somalis like MJ and Salah face many more dangers than when he was a teenager here in the 90s. Mukhtar points out that he had the benefit of Somali bilingual teachers in high school and the now closed General College, a gateway program at the University of Minnesota.
When I was in high school, we did not have any gang-related issues, or we didn't know what the juvenile system was. Nowadays, you know, you have young people who are dropping out of high school. You have young people who are doing drugs.
But one of the most visible problems in this neighborhood is inertia, young adults with nothing to do. Some of them hang out in front of the liquor store on Cedar Avenue. Others come to the Coyle Center in the middle of the afternoon to play basketball. It's Abdurrahman Mukhtar's job to open the gym for them.
The only thing that I can do for them is keep them inside so I can keep them away from getting into trouble.
To MJ, idle young men are cautionary tales.
I look at them and it helps me because I don't want to end up like them. I want to be a better person, live in this society, and succeed in life.
As president of the youth council, MJ leads meetings with a firm hand.
Sit across from me.
He says to make it in this world, order is important. Mentors in the neighborhood look out for him, and MJ looks out for younger kids like Salah, who is the council's so-called spokesman. Today, MJ is talking about firing one of his friends from the position of vice president.
I don't think this vice president wants to work hard for their position.
Just because she missed one day, like presidents do miss meetings sometimes.
I'm not trying to put her down because she missed today's meeting, okay? No, I'm trying to send her a message. I understand that there is priority for her family. I understand that.
Family comes first.
Family comes first. So does the youth council.
The adults in the room, including a couple of security guards, are trying to suppress their smiles. But MJ is right, in a way. Discipline and accountability can help move people up and out of poverty. In MJ's case, he credits his mom with keeping him on track. She turns off the TV and prods him to read. Another tenacious mom, Raho Warsami, is starting up the stove in her South Minneapolis townhouse. Warsami is about to ladle some batter onto a pan. She's making injera, which is like a Somali pancake. Her grown daughters are watching her from the kitchen table.
Today I'm the breakfast maker, and I make my dough because they're not good at it.
When the bread is ready, Warsami joins her daughters at the table for the first meal of the new year. She's a single mom of four who was a nurse in Somalia before coming to Minnesota in the mid-90s. Her family's first home was in the towers. They lived on the 32nd floor, where Warsami used to plan for emergencies with military precision, running up and down the stairs.
I was trained myself saying, okay, if there is something happened in the elevator and not working, how you carry your children and safe. So that's what I was doing it.
Yeah, my mom's different.
That's Warsami's 24-year-old daughter, Farhio Yusuf. Farhio graduated from St. Catherine University. Her younger sister, Miriam, is a freshman at the University of Minnesota. Miriam says a lot of her friends' parents don't ask their kids about their daily lives. Her mom is not one of those parents.
I just look back and I feel like she's right there. She's kind of like, I don't know, she's like a lieutenant, so it's scary sometimes.
But Miriam says her mom's needling paid off. Warsami was separated from her husband while fleeing Somalia's civil war. She says here in Minnesota, it wasn't easy raising their four kids on her own. There were days when she was exasperated.
When you come from work, you don't want to talk even. You've done your day. But you have children and you don't have a way out. You have to go to the school saying, you know, how's my child doing and why he receiving this grade and what they could do better.
Warsami went to English class and found a decent paying job at the post office. She set goals for herself and clawed her way to self-sufficiency. Today, she's a property manager with a nonprofit housing group. She says coming to Minnesota, where good jobs were abundant, was one of the best things she ever did for her family. Back at the COIL Center, Abdurrahman Mukhtar, the youth manager, is rounding up a sea of kids, including MJ and Salah. He zips up their winter coats and makes sure they're properly bundled up. They're here holding signs to protest a recent suicide bombing in Somalia. Among the dozens killed in Mogadishu were students graduating from a medical school. They were young people, too, considered to be their country's best hopes. Mukhtar tears up when he thinks about the peers he left behind in Somalia. He knows he's lucky, but the trade-off, he says, is that there's a missing piece of him that will haunt him for as long as his homeland remains a war zone.
We are the most fortunate and unfortunate generation. We are very fortunate because we are here in America getting education, we have food and shelter, but we're also unfortunate because if I want to go back to Somalia, I cannot do that because it doesn't exist.
Mukhtar says for Civil War kids like him, the best they can do is help raise a young generation of Somali Americans the right way. He pushes them to do their homework and to stay away from drugs. Mukhtar says maybe one of these kids can help rebuild a distant homeland. But first, they have to beat the odds here. Laura Yuen, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.